Live on digital radio, colorfulradio.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Enjoy new drama tonight on BTTV. Season 3 of AMC's Fear the Walking Dead is exclusive to BT customers.
It's a ride now, at all costs.
TV and satellite, we call it a five-star thrill ride.
Why are you doing this?
Watch Fear the Walking Dead tonight on BTTV, where you'll find top-quality drama, kids' shows, and blockbuster movies. Plus, if you want to catch up on seasons 1 and 2, you can own them now by buying them on the BT TV store. To find out more, visit bt.com/TV. BT TV. Big entertainment, tiny prices.
You'll need BT broadband and a fast enough line. Recording functionality available with selected BT TV packs. Terms apply.
It's the end of another week, but we're just getting started with our critical take on the film business and the business of film. In the company of Paul Atherton, Paulette Harris-German, Dabo Sledge and Isaac Tomicek. I'm Emmanuel Anyamasigwe, and if it's Friday night, it is Meet the Critics. Those of you just joining us, we thank you. Glad to have your company also. Right, we have a lot to get through before the hour passes us, and so I'd like, if I may, for all of us here to make a start on our discussion about the legacy of Richard Pryor, who was born Richard Franklin Lennox Thomas Pryor in 1940. Pryor was, amongst other things, a social critic known for uncompromising examinations of racism and topical contemporary issues, which employed colourful vulgarities and profanity, as well as racial epithets. He reached a broad audience with his trenchant observations and storytelling style. He is widely regarded as one of the most important and influential stand-up comedians of all time. Jerry Seinfeld called Pryor the Picasso of our profession, and Dave Chappelle said of Pryor, "You know those like evolution charts of man? He was the dude walking upright." So clearly that's not a Dave Chappelle impersonation. Richard was the highest evolution of comedy. This legacy can be attributed in part to the unusual degree of intimacy Pryor brought to bear in his comedy. As Bill Cosby reportedly once said, Richard Pryor drew the line between comedy and tragedy as thin as one could possibly paint it. Pryor won an Emmy Award and 5 Grammy Awards, along with 2 American Academy of Humor Awards and the Writers Guild of America Award. He was listed at number 1 on Comedy Central's list of all-time greatest stand-up comedians, and earlier this year, Rolling Stone magazine ranked him first on its list of the 50 best stand-up comics of all time. And as we'll discover in the next few moments or so, his body of work is endless. And so to help drill this down, let's hear from our critics about their favourite all-time Richard Pryor movie. Paul Atherton, good evening.
Evening, Emmanuel. For me, it's got to be Stir Crazy. I mean, his performances with Gene Wilder were just stunning. His timing was impeccable. He just owned the screen. He brought an audience in with him. But it was also seismic for me as a child because he was a black guy just performing. He wasn't performing as a black guy. He happened to be black, but he was on that screen with Gene Wilder. They were double billing. They were at the top of their game, and it was a laugh a minute. And everybody who saw that film loved that film. I have yet to meet a single human being who has seen that film and has it. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen, and literally couldn't stop laughing from start to finish. So it was incredibly seismic. And he said something about black culture and about just through that film. That just went, we're all the same. Don't worry about it. I can be as funny as any other guy on the planet, and I'm doing it with a black skin.
Paulette?
I have to agree with Paul. It is Stir Crazy for me, although I do have some other favorites. But just to add to what Paul was saying as well, not only did Richard encompass the passion or the duality of cultures within that role, but also the pathos, just some of those escape scenes and how he interacted with Gene Wilder on the screen with the subject matter also underpinned the story and unpacked like the historical stuff that was going on behind the scenes, because it was set in a prison, wasn't it? And just the escape. I'm sorry, I'm just thinking about some of the scenes. I'm just laughing. Just that scene when they were underneath the thing and they were having to roll out. And just the whole clown scene. So for those of you who haven't seen this, spoiler alert. There was just so much going on, but the human connectedness when people find themselves in a difficult situation where things like colour and all of that just goes out of the window really came across in that film, and they both played it to a fault.
Daryl?
I would have to say it's a collection of Richard Pryor films. I do have to admit the charisma between he and Gene Wilder, it was something very amazing. It was just like firecrackers. Mm-hmm. I loved a lot of Richard Pryor movies. My favorite, I would say, is probably Harlem Nights, because it showed a different disposition of Richard. Although the character, you know, they were doing things during that time, 1940s Harlem or whatever. But he just displayed this different persona, and it just made me really look at him as a well-rounded actor and performer, and so it just really made me like his work even more so. I don't have a favorite, because anything Richard Pryor does is my favorite, so I would say a collection of his films.
I see.
Yeah, I feel like a bit of a fraud, because like his films, I enjoyed them a lot, and like Daryl was saying, I kind of, there's a collection of films that I like, but his stand-up for me was the kind of stuff that really now I love. The films, I guess one of the first films I saw as a child was Brewster's Millions, so I think that it's not his best film, but it was just of that 80s era, you know, excess, capitalism, anything's possible, just funny, silly, John Candy and him. He seemed to have a really good rapport with his on-screen partners, and I think that's a testament to the man that he enjoyed it. He was friendly. They look like they're having fun. There's nothing better than watching people on screen that look like they're enjoying themselves. Mm-hmm. I will enjoy it as well. So yeah, I think Brewster's Millions, it's a classic, really, isn't it?
It is a classic. That was the first film I watched of Richard Pryor, and then I had to watch Stir Crazy and then See No Evil, Hear No Evil. So for me, those three just.
What's the first one you would show your children? Because that's, I think, because you can't show them the stand-up. That's the thing. You can't show your six-year-olds Live and Smoking.
if I'm honest, I might have to. I might, because actually, you've put me in a very tricky situation, because my wife, who listens to this show, will know what I'm about to say, which is why precisely I'm not going to say it. So we'll move swiftly on. We'll talk about that during the break. But Daryl, you have a connection with Richard Pryor through his daughter. Talk to us about that.
Yes, Rain. Well, I produced Rain's off-Broadway show, her one-woman show, which deals with her growing up, Rain Pryor, the daughter of this great legend, this icon, Richard Pryor. And what was amazing for me in learning more about Richard Pryor and being engulfed in that arena was that how sensitive and passionate this man was. Rain and I would certainly always go out to some cafe in Manhattan and have coffee, and you know she would smoke her cigarettes, and we would talk about her childhood. And one of the things that I really enjoyed hearing was how he was such a hands-on dad. Rain would always talk about the lessons learned from her father and how he taught his children to be young men and young women, and how they had to be respectful of their elders and anyone, and, you know, always having an amiable disposition when they are out in public and when they're out meeting people. So that was something, you know, really exciting for me to learn, because we see this man on screen and television, and we see this comic and this comedian, and we're thinking that's what his life is. But he was a very much hands-on father, and that was something I was happy to hear about.
And what do you think of Rain Pryor, the comedian? I mean, such a hard act to follow, but she actually pulls it off, doesn't she?
She does. What I love about Rain, despite the fact that she and I are like brothers and sisters, you know, Rain understands that she's in her father's shadow, you know, but she does things her way. She's not trying to be her dad. She's not trying to emulate him or fool anyone to believe that she's him. She knows that she's not him, and she would never be him. But she tells her truth, and her truth comes from her experience of being this man's daughter. You know, it has to be hard for her because I don't have a parent that was a performer or world renowned, but it has to be hard for her. But I think she understands that, you know, I'm not Richard Pryor, I'm his daughter. And what I'm telling you and what I'm giving you is my experience of being his daughter.
Now, as you know, how we came to know each other was through That Daughter's Crazy, which was a film that I showed in my capacity as director of the British Urban Film Festival. And it was an incredible experience for everyone that watched the film, and for Rain to be so open about what life was like being his daughter.
Yeah.
Now, I know before the screening, when I got to know you and Rain, we talked about the biopic, which has been much talked about in terms of who would play Richard Pryor. Do you have a view or a preference as to who would or should play him?
I don't even know if the film has been cast. Mike Epps has the role now, I believe. That was the last thing I was told. I would want someone who certainly believed in the Richard Pryor, is someone who can, you know, capture those moments and those nuances of Richard and really, really become Richard and really delve into the aspect of who Richard Pryor is, was. I don't really have a preference. I would certainly hope that it's a capable actor, no matter where that actor is from, but a capable actor, one who can really, really bring to life the evolution and the reality of who Richard Pryor is, was for so many people. I found doing this play, her producing Maine's one-woman show and in producing the film, that people are very, very passionate about Richard Pryor, and they're serious about it. And if you're going to talk about Richard Pryor, if you're going to do Richard Pryor, try to be Richard Pryor, then you really need to do that. So I don't really have a preference. I just hope that whomever plays Richard Pryor in this biopic is someone who would do it total justice and will make all of us proud and will make the Pryor family proud.
Guys, any thoughts as to who should play him?
I think it probably should be an unknown. I think, you know, they should be looking for some, excuse the pun, some raw talent that's, you know, on the verge of something really great. And, you know, this is a great platform to allow somebody as a breakthrough film. Because otherwise, any name that you, I mean, I remember the film Ray, and it worked, but you did spend a lot of time knowing who the actor was.
Yeah.
And I think for something like this, you do want a fresh palette. So you're kind of going, I'm not watching X, Y, and Z on the screen. I'm watching Pryor.
Indeed.
Right, right. I agree with that.
Go on, Darryl.
I agree with that, because I think sometimes if the actor is too big, that, you know, they can overcompensate and they can take your imagination away from this performance. It was like that with Malcolm X. Denzel is such a huge star. You can't help but to realize that you're watching him on screen, although it was a great performance and he's a great actor. But you can't help, you can't escape that. So I think if you can find a raw talent, one who is very in depth with the acting technique and bring that, it offers a fresh perspective to this project.
I think it also depends on the concept of the film itself, because a biopic, you know, a straightforward biopic, I'm not really down for that. I'd rather see something, you know, Richard Pryor was such a colourful personality. His life had such varying degrees of events and elements that I think there is a real potential to take his story and turn it into something very interesting. You know, a friend of mine has just written a biopic about Frank Bruno, but it's not actually about Frank Bruno, it's about his daughter.
Right.
You know, the I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan biopic, had Bob Dylan played by five different people at five different stages in their life. I think there's potential to do something where you can have a Mike Epps playing Richard Pryor when he's just about to kind of, you know, do his last ever stand-up show. And then you've got, you know, some kids playing him when he grew up in a whorehouse. Like, I want to see that shit, you know, sorry.
Yeah, no, it is.
But I think there's that, you know.
Yeah,
it is after 9 o'clock.
The dynamics of his parents and their roles, because the fact that one's a prostitute, one's a pimp, but they also had day jobs, which is a bit mad. And then his grandmother running the whorehouse and being so violent against him. And just unpacking what that would have been like for him as a child looking up into that atmosphere. Because people talk about him using that and drawing on that as a blueprint for his material. Mm. But it wasn't until he had the fallout in Las Vegas when he stopped doing the kind of whole Bill Cosby type performance that he went away and really came into himself. And I would like to see what was going on in his mind, what actually flipped him over, what did he witness looking back at him from the whole Rat Pack experience that tipped him over and made him say, no, I'm going to do me, because it's such an extreme, it's a massive leap.
I think, to be honest, it's a poison chalice for any director or writer trying to make a 2-hour movie about him. I think you look at, we know that TV is where it's at right now. Make it a TV series, make it a mini series, four hour episodes. Give us the real, give us the real deal. Netflix, Hulu, where are you? Come on, let's get someone involved. Andre Holland to play him in like his 30s. Let's do this properly.
Well, I was going to say about Netflix, because obviously recently they've had the Dave Chappelle specials, Chris Rock specials. Seems to be a lot of comedians ending up on Netflix. I mean, that's for another show about the legacy of Netflix.
But is there a legacy now?
There's a legacy for everything. But for me, it's interesting, because with Richard Pryor, like you said, there's so many angles you can take it, but will it do it justice? I mean, another thing I was thinking of was, should the family get involved? Because you always have these issues, especially with biopics, whereby the family is cut off, the loved ones, the friends, whatever. I mean, Tupac comes to mind as well, but I talk about Richard Pryor here, but
I think it's like the process of any film. You know, there's going to be a script writing process, there's going to be a story development process. I'd like to think that the screenwriters would acknowledge the family at least, and sort of talk to them about it. But I'm always concerned, because, you know, obviously the family want to paint a particular picture, and that doesn't let you as a filmmaker tell the story that you want to tell often.
A great example is the Straight Outta Compton movie. Right. Straight Outta Compton, you know, it works. It was great to see that story on screen, but there's a lot of stuff that should have been on screen that needs to be told, because that's what made those people who they are. And unfortunately, because the people involved had too much involvement, they could paint over some of the things that happened, you know. And I think you cannot have a Richard Pryor film without the real Richard Pryor, the stuff that he talked about. If he's prepared to stand on stage and talk about this stuff, then we need to see it depicted. We don't want to water down Richard.
But surely only the family can.
Exactly. So there has to be, you know, Daryl will probably know better than us. If his family are willing to kind of just hand over responsibility to a talented writer, then you could have a really good.
They'd still have some sign off on the script, though.
Yeah,
some
we don't have to see him shoot in his car.
Yeah, I mean, Daryl, what does Rain think?
I learned so many things that the normal person would not know about Richard Pryor, just having that relationship with his daughter. We talked about a lot of things. She gave me an example of how he drive her to school in the limousine, and how they would have that conversations, and how when she would go and move him and live with him when she received, when she became a certain age, those experiences. A lot of people don't know those things. And I was fortunate to, you know, have her to give me all of those things. And when we went out to California to film, I got a chance to meet his in-laws and, you know, hearing stories from that perspective. So, I think you have to have the family involved to some degree. But I certainly see the aspect of not to paint this picture that they want us to see, but, you know, to just dispel the truth.
Okay, Paulette, you wanted to come in there.
It's exactly what I was saying near the end. It's about, especially from a female perspective, because there are those other, like the relationship with his mum. Like one of the documentaries I watched, he actually rekindled his relationship with his mum and had her in an audience and just seeing her face. I'd never seen that before. And the fact that he was big enough and open-hearted enough to rekindle that relationship and have her in an audience. I mean, she was visibly upset, but to hear what it was like for her, although it's his story, you know, what insight then, Daryl, that Rain would have about that coming back together of her grandmother and her maternal grandmother and her dad, because that's another side of the story that as a mother I would like to hear.
We are discussing the film business and the business of film, and I'm in the company of Paul Atherton, Paulette Harris-German, Daryl Sledge and Isaac Tomacek. Right, this is where things get slightly interesting, because this is a blank piece of paper kind of topic, which simply is called the White Mandela question. So picture this situation. A Nelson Mandela film is about to get made, and the producers are thinking of casting a white actor for the role. Should that happen in this day and age? Who wants to start this off?
Oh, I will, obviously. I think it shouldn't be a decision of whether it should be black or white. It should be a decision about what the story's telling. You know, we've seen the Bob Dylan thing where people have taken different roles, and that made perfect sense because of what the director was attempting to achieve. So if there is a good cause for it, I think the danger that we have is that we start talking black and white. And then we go, all right, we must cast a black person in this role because we need more black faces on the screen, or we must cast a white person in this role because it balances it out. If we start talking like that, I think we've lost the argument to begin with. So if the story drives it, if the narrative wants it, if the director has a vision that requires it, sure, why not?
But we're talking about historical figures.
Yep. And as we said, it's been done with Bob Dylan. Mm. You know, there was a living historical figure. Mm. And, you know, we've seen it done with Michael Jackson. We've seen it done on the stage show, actually, rather than the recent film, television series. You know, where you use women to play the role, you use white people to play the role. It's about what the director's trying to get across, and it's about what the script and the story. Now, but if you're just going, oh, let's put a white person because black people, you know, that would be just foolish.
I mean, you mentioned Michael Jackson. I mean, earlier this year, there was the whole furore about Joseph Fiennes.
Yeah.
And Sky had to pull the drama ultimately.
Yeah.
So obviously they bowed down to public pressure. So
well, because it's a commercial channel, and they went, oh, okay, we're not going to get a big enough audience, so we'll kill it before it starts.
It's also with that. The premise of that is stories that may or may not have taken place, and I think with that the pressure was that now in the age of social media, basically, the moment something is tweeted or posted, everyone has their opinion. And if you think about sort of Little Britain, let's say, I was watching an episode of Little Britain the other day, 2004, there are things in that where they are blackface, where they are dressed pretending to be Indian people, Indian men. And this is before social media, so there was no reaction the next day, apart from water cooler talk, people going into work saying, did you see that episode of Little Britain? It wasn't put out there to the world immediately. And you watch it now, and it is in bad taste. But back then, people didn't really have the same reaction. So I think the trouble with the Michael Jackson example is that it was a comedy show. It's almost like Drunk Histories, Horrible right. Histories. It wasn't literal. It was played for laughs, and everyone just jumped on the fact that a white guy was playing Michael Jackson. So before the show had even had a chance to air, before people had even taken the show into context, we had this reaction to it. And I think that, like you're saying, is the problem is we have to judge it by the story and not by the scenario. Do you know what I mean? We can't just say, oh, it's a black actor, it's a white actor. If the story demands a little bit of creativity and a little bit of, you know, open-mindedness, then why not?
So what's your view on Ali G?
Again, that was wrong. It was wrong. But at the time... I don't know, I watched an episode of it recently again, and at the time, you watch it now and you can't say it's wrong.
I'm just speechless. I mean, for me, this whole colorblind casting thing, it works for fictional characters, in my opinion. So if you've got your Shakespeare's, you can afford right. to mess around with gender casting and color casting and all of that, because they're fictional. But I think when it's something that is going to be going down in history as a record of what actually happened, I think it needs to be authentic. I don't see where how the creativity around the screenplay is going to dictate too much or make that much of a difference about who the person's casted. I would like to see that. I'm not saying there's not room for it, but if it's something that is going to be there as an actual legacy to that individual, then it should be authentically cast.
But
there is room for creativity in another yes. side project, but not the one that is going to be the legacy piece.
I'd just like to take up on that Ali G point, though.
Yes.
Because I think a lot of people get confused as well about what a character is. Now, Ali G was playing a Staines boy, playing someone that was trying to pretend to be black, and that was the humour. And I think a lot of people went, well, actually, he's just mocking black people. And you're like, no, he's mocking white people who are emulating black people. Mm. And I think often, and as you say, you know, it often gets lost in the period of time. There is a moment in time where something works, and then latterly, when you look back on it, I mean, Men Behaving Badly springs to mind for me. But, you know, back in the 80s, a television series, which, you know, was hysterical when we watched it, but we watch now and we just kind of wince and go, what on earth were we thinking? But in its moment, it makes perfect sense. So I think there's a danger.
It depended on who you were, though, Paul, because in that moment, Allergy never made sense. And they filmed the film right there near me at Wilson Sports Centre. The kids loved it, but it was just the stereotypes and there's no context. And I think that's where it becomes a problem. Because we in London, we're kind of in our little bubble and we think that the rest of this country and the rest of the world is very multicultural, but it isn't. And so a lot of their information that they're getting outside of the M25 is from the media. And so that's their perception of what they perceive. They're not going to worry about whether it's a Staines person being there, all of that.
I grew up in Wales, we did.
the funny you were waiting to say that.
And did the fact that it was played by a Jewish man sully the waters even further?
Yes, it did.
But I think there's the other thing is, for me, with Ali G, watching it again recently, it's not so much what he's doing, it's the reaction of the people he's doing it to, because the people think he's black. And that, I think, is the problem a lot of the time, that you watch it and go, they're going, oh, and is it because I was black? Yeah, you're black. No, he's not. And that then just adds a whole other cloud over the layers of kind of what he's trying to subvert. So, yeah, I think that's the problem.
And I think the thing is as well, even though you've got the humour behind it, if there was a black person in acting as Ali G, they would never get that kind of exposure. They would never get those bookings. It wouldn't work.
Richard Blackwood's show, what, lasted maybe one season?
Darryl, are you familiar with Ali G, incidentally?
I am. He's done some work over here in America. Yeah, you know who he is. I'm not a big follower of his work, but yeah, I am familiar with him. But I have to piggyback on what Paulette said. I agree. If it's fiction, I think there's room for discovery and room for creativity. But if it's dealing with nonfiction and it's dealing with historical figures, I think we have to remain true to that. And I think it would be a disservice for us to, cast outside of that reality. So I have to agree with, I agree a lot with what Paulette said.
Isaac, you want to come in?
Yeah, I'll give you a good example. So, you know, Force Awakens, first trailer, John Boyega, bang. The vitriol of there being a black stormtrooper, a fictional product that spent all of its time behind a white helmet. We didn't know that stormtroopers were even human. But I always thought they were robots. Suddenly, the moment there's a black stormtrooper, Twitter is going off. Why was that a problem to people? You know, it's just it's ludicrous. And I think with fiction, it's fine. You can do what you want. Hermione is now black on stage.
Yes,
played by a middle-aged woman.
And, yeah, and up for an award.
Oh, I think she won the Olivier as well. So it's like with that, you can, you know, if you're making a film set in space about green little aliens and what have you, and you can do what you want.
But the irony of the whole Noma and Harry Potter scenario is J.K. Rowling herself came out and said, I never said that Hermione was white.
Yeah.
And that kind of like just then really threw the cat amongst the pigeons.
Yes, it was the people who claimed
perception.
Ownership.
It's the same
her,
thing with James Bond.
You know, I mean, you know.
I have a thing about James Bond.
That's for another show.
No. We could do the James Bond one's very easy. I feel like Idris can play 006, but I think when you, because changing it on that level feels like a stunt cast to me. Do you see what I mean? It feels like a bit of a stunt cast. I do think the 007 is just like, if they've just, it's like if Idris wants to be James Bond, let's do a different James Bond, but in the same universe. But when you try and sort of just go pass the baton from a Daniel Craig to an Idris Elba and expect everyone to just go, cool, it does fit, that there is something, there is a little bit.
But then
of
why is it okay to go from Sean Connery to Roger Moore to Pierce Brosnan or whomever. Yeah. Hello?
I think my example is if they wanted to do James Bond, it's like, let's do a universe where you have a 1960s sort of set James Bond in the Cold War with Tom Hiddleston. Do a James Bond where it's a young James Bond and it's John Boyega and he's coming out of a MI5 Academy. Spread it out that way. Don't just expect me to go from Spectre to Elba, you know, like don't expect me to do that, because the chances of it succeeding are going to be slim to none, because you're asking for a massive leap of faith and you're putting a lot of pressure.
But how are we able to do that with Moneypenny? Naomi Harris went straight into Moneypenny.
But they eased her in, because she wasn't Moneypenny straight away. Initially, they did it by the end of the film. She was just a secretary, and then it was like, oh, I'm Moneypenny.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's.
But I mean, the bottom line is, you know, Ripley was a male character, right, in Alien. And, you know, who could ever imagine anybody other than Sigourney Weaver playing Ripley? I think I agree with you to a point. And I think the commercial side of this will always win out, and which by definition means, you know, I have to agree with you entirely. But I think you, with a new audience, and I think what you're saying in sort of Bourne Legacy style, where you kind of... evolve a new brand that is the same universe, then that seems to work. It's a shame, because I think we should just go, right, you know, it's 21st century, guys. You know, it's just, we'll cast whoever we want to cast, whether that be a woman or a black guy or whoever.
So the same would go for Doctor Who, which they're talking about now.
No.
Well, here we go. Because that's filmed in Wales, isn't it?
But I think the thing is, but again, can you see the common thread here is ownership. It's about what you prefer. It's about what you like. It's about a preference. It has nothing to do with fact. It's not legitimate. It just comes down to, I like it this way. Mm. Please don't F with my stuff, right? Mm. So it's like, for me, it's don't try and make, like, you know, if they try and make a sequel to season 6 of The Wire, no thank you. It ended perfectly.
But are we saying that James Bond is broken as a brand? To the extent where they're thinking of Idris Elba?
No, they're just...
They just spin this stuff to get great news stories. And you know, everybody speculates. I mean, Daniel's already saying it for another 3 years, I think. But yeah, you know, I mean, it's the way that the Bond universe has promoted their films for decades. Mm. Mm. They go, right, first we'll spill, you know, we'll get Tom Hiddleston in and we'll do this and we'll have a chat with these guys and then we'll cover it all in the press. And then, we knew who we were doing it all along. Anyway, you know, we'd worked that out 15 years ago. And then they release it. So,
I mean, I have it on good authority that Tom is the favourite to actually get it.
This is the thing. If for me, James Bond hasn't, they haven't written a person of colour into the film in a strong enough way in the last decade for me to suddenly go, they're going to do a really good job writing James Bond for Idris without it just being a stunt casting to kind of shape up with this what's going on in sort of the cinematic world at the moment. Like, Moneypenny is underwritten. She's an underwritten character. Until they give me, like, you know, a partner for James Bond that is played by, I don't know, David Oyelowo, or just someone, I will not believe that they are going to give me James Bond, 007, Idris Elba, for it being anything other than just...
I mean, Felix turned black in...
Felix Leiter.
In Pierce Brosnan's news, right? And, I mean, that was done quite subtly. I thought they pulled that off really well without any sort of...
But where was he in the second? Where was he in the second? First one, and then... Sorry. Get heated.
Darryl?
Darryl's
speechless. Can you hear me, Darryl?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, right, okay. Yes, we're talking about James Bond, so I guess the conversation's moved on to the Black James Bond question, which was for another show, incidentally, so I'm going to have to rip up the script. But now that we're talking about it, do you have a view about the James Bond franchise, as it were?
Well, this is going to seem a little, probably, I don't know. I think it just should not play James Bond. We are accustomed to seeing James Bond be a certain being, although he's been played by different actors. They were all white actors, and so there's a commonality with that. We're used to that. I think if we want to insert Idris into this program, create a new character, 006, like the gentleman said, or 005 or whatever, and start a new franchise with it.
Sure. I mean, that sounds... I mean, I don't think Idris should get it personally. A lot of people have asked me who should play James Bond. I think Johnny Lee Miller would make a great James Bond.
Mm. Listen, it comes down to, it's not even who you think, it comes down to what movie do you want to watch. If you give me a Christopher Nolan directed Tom Hardy James Bond, I'll pay good money to see that. I'll pay good money to see that. If you're giving me Tom Hiddleston with Sam Mendes, no thanks. I've seen that already.
It's each of their own, isn't it? I mean, for me, Elementary is my favourite TV programme, so I'm going to have to say Johnny Lee Miller. Which Darryl is a producer on as well, but that's not why he's on the show. But
I'd rather see Lucy Liu play James Bond, to be honest.
That would work.
That would be, for me, Lucy Liu as James Bond, coming out of rehab. Wow, that would be sick.
Yeah. Darryl, this all makes sense, doesn't it? It all makes sense now. Darryl?
Lucy can't do any wrong. Yes, I'm okay. Can't do any wrong.
Yeah, so obviously, for people that don't know, you work on Elementary, which, as I've just said, is my favourite TV program.
Yeah, one of mine as well.
Talk to us a bit about your work as a producer. I mean, what is it like working with Lucy Liu, and how the producers thought of a female playing Watson?
Mm. Oh, well... Lucy is an amazing person, just one of the most wonderful people I've ever met in the industry. And I met a lot of people, and there's no, you know, no pretension or anything like that. She's just a wonderful person. I think the producers wanted to mix it up a little bit, and they wanted to come from a different angle. I think they wanted to show us a woman that was in a position of strength, and one who can help solve things and place female character on the.
We've lost you, Daryl. So I'm going to go to Paul because he said Elementary is his favourite show as well.
What I was going to say.
So yes, talk to us about Elementary and kind of the producer's kind of thinking behind.
Yeah, so it's really her show.
Yeah, it is definitely her show because she's directed a few episodes as well. Is that right?
Yes. She's directed a few episodes. Actually, she's directing other episodic television as well. But she's a very smart person, and she understands that role, and she brings it. Actually, when I'm walking in the streets of New York, and people know that I work on that show, they say they watch it because of Lucy. And I think she just brings that. She just brings that aura with her when she's on screen. You enjoy watching her on screen. I know I do. I think she's beautiful. As a woman, but she's just very smart, and she just brings something new to the character, and it makes it fresh.
But isn't there something about the fact that she's a female, though, Daryl, that puts a whole different energy and a whole different spin on the storylines?
Of course, because we're used to seeing those characters be white males, and here's an Asian woman who's, you know, not tall and statuesque or anything like that. Beautiful, but not tall and statuesque. And and she's, you know, she's not white and she's not black, and she's an Asian woman. And it just gives it a different spin. It gives it a freshness to it. And I think that's what makes people really enjoy it. And that's why we got picked up for a sixth season.
Brilliant.
Well then.
Yeah, Paul. Talk to us about Elementary from your point of view watching it.
Oh, well, I remember seeing the first episode and being just completely blown away because they understood the original narrative, obviously being a Londoner now. I was very keen about making sure that that sort of kept the heritage of the story, which they do brilliantly. But the fact that, you know, she's the controlling voice in this, you know, normally it's always Sherlock is saying, and Watson's usually the bumbling idiot in the background, especially from the sort of the classic one. And suddenly there was this incredibly beautiful, incredibly powerful woman leading, you know, taking this guy's life and putting it back together. I mean, that was the thing I loved about it. When I first saw the first episode, I was like, this is just genius. Because they drew you in, they kept all the nods to what should be there. And I love what they do with the Deerstalker as well. But it was, you kind of went, that typical British moment of going, oh, the Americans have taken something of ours again. What are they doing? This is going to be another Fawlty Towers. But it wasn't. It was really, really good. And it's what the Americans do really, really well when they get it right. The writing was superb. The acting was brilliant. The concept was great. And it really didn't. I mean, I've literally followed pretty much every episode now. I don't think I've missed an episode.
I'm playing catch up.
I've never seen an episode.
Oh, you need to watch.
I know, and I feel like a fraud because I'm sat here and everyone's waxing lyrical about it. The closest I've come to watching an episode is when I saw some of it being filmed in Brooklyn. I was walking down, I can't even remember where it was, walking down this road in Brooklyn, and there was this huge film crew, and I was like, what is
probably
this?
In Dumbo.
Yeah, they were like, it's Elementary. I was like, no, what is it? No, it's Elementary, the show. I was like, okay. Never seen it. So yeah, I'm gonna have to watch it now.
Just out of interest, what do you think about the British Sherlock?
It was great for the first two series, and then
trailed
out miserably. But I remember the first episode. It was the first time I even sat. I don't really watch stuff on telly live anymore. And I remember that was, ooh, new Sherlock Sunday night. I sat down, watched it, loved it. But since then, it's just the last two series have been ropey.
Have you watched the British Sherlock, Daryl?
No, I have not.
I guess you don't need to in Elementary.
There's a British Sherlock?
Exactly.
Well, you know, it's a strange situation because I work in television, but I don't watch television. And I've worked on, you know, Elementary, and I've seen maybe two episodes on television because I figure, why watch it? I'm there when we're making it. I've seen it already. I haven't watched it. And I'm sad to say that I need to do better with watching, you know, television more. I'm not familiar with that version.
Sure. Okay, we'll leave it there. We've got more to talk about. We'll continue our conversation about the White Mandela question. We've moved from Mandela to Bond to Elementary, Lucy Liu. But there's so many more areas that we can go into, and we will do that in just a couple of moments. I'm Emmanuel Nanyi-Masigwe, and if it's Friday night, it is Meet the Critics. We are still discussing the issue of colorblind casting, although I've been corrected that it's just casting, purely. I'm in the company of Paul Atherton, Paulette Harris-German, Darryl Sledge, and Isaac Tomacek. And I guess it is a pertinent point what you said there. I mean, why we're having to call it colorblind casting in the first place is, you know, a bit of an anomaly, isn't it?
Well, for me, I mean, the strangest thing for me historically, when I was growing up in the 80s, there was no notion of black casting because nearly everybody in major films were black. So whether it was Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, Denzel Washington, you know, pretty much every major A-list star in the world when I was a kid growing up was black. Nobody thought anything of it. And then suddenly we kind of went through a decade of the 90s, and by the time we hit the 2000s, and, you know, after the slavery reparations and apologies in Westminster Cathedral, and Blair sort of changing from the BFI to the UK Film Council and this very focused thing, and then people were going, oh, you know, black people aren't really that clever and they're not there. And suddenly I felt really subjugated, having been sort of empowered with, you know, I mean, Will Smith was... on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was the most watched television
by
series
everyone
of all time.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you know, the Cosby Show was obviously being played on television screens over here. So, you know, everywhere we looked, it was just totally accepted. It wasn't it wasn't like, oh my God, it's a black actor. But suddenly now, 20, 30 years later, we're kind of going, oh gosh, black actor.
But I think the switch of that is, they weren't necessarily telling black stories. It was, you know, The Fresh Prince is a very unique example of a story about a black family, you know,
living in a White House,
yeah, inhabiting a, you know, part of affluent society. But when you look at sort of the film, you know, when you look at the other films or the other examples of that sort of stuff, they were almost niche, like Menace to Society, Boys in the Hood, Juice. All these films were like, you know, they have one a year, set it off, one a year, make loads of money, and the crazy thing is, these films were making money. They were making money. They were number one. Set It Off was number one. Friday was number one. House Party was number one. All these movies would go to number
school
one. They'd school days. They'd make dough. And then they'd just sort of disappear. And it's ironic that now you're looking at films like Fast and the Furious. People are going, wow, that's made $1 billion. And everyone in that movie is different. Everyone in that movie is women, Mexicans, black, Chinese, like everyone in it.
You know, Gene Roddenberry kind of kicked that all off his Star Trek.
Yeah, exactly.
You see, I was never watched Fast and the Furious.
Like that, so I was going to say, man, you say something like that and it throws me back to Melvin Van Peebles' Badass song, when he did have that kind of makeup, but it was illegal. And then here we are all these years on that you are able to do it. But what I'm conscious of in this particular conversation is everything we're mentioning. We're here in the UK, everything's American.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where it has made a big difference here is we no longer have No Problem. We no longer have The Real McCoy and all of those British black programs, Empire Road, The Fosters.
Desmond's.
That we got Desmond. Yeah. Well, Desmond's is still on. It's on Live or...
London Live.
Yeah. but those others... We just
Real McCoy, they found, by the way.
Yeah, they found Real McCoy.
All of a sudden, that's another conversation. Yes. I'll be political. I promise not to do politics this year.
You should really. No,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, because we had Chris Tummins on, what was that, on Channel 4?
Yes.
Get Up, Stand Up, Blouse and Skirts. All of that stuff that we had, remember Brothers and Sisters?
Yeah.
Nothing. And it's nowhere to be seen. So generations like Isaac's and my son's, they're not seeing our legacy.
Yeah.
We're seeing all of the American stuff and it's all easily accessible via the internet. But where's all the stuff that we created in the 80s and the 90s?
I mean, Real McCoy to me, I'm not that young. Real McCoy.
You're looking good, Bob.
Thank you. I remember Real McCoy. And Real McCoy to me was like the litmus test of that show was heavy. That was wicked. And there hasn't been a Real McCoy since the Real McCoy.
No.
So you're right. We always look to America because they were just doing it. They had, you know, Living Colour.
Yeah, no,
world,
absolutely.
All them shows, and so we never had that. But yeah, I know, different world.
But that's where our inspiration comes from, and that's why I am an avid BET fan. I spend.
Oh my God!
You have to understand,
that's
Darryl.
The television you watch, Darryl.
Darryl, that's all we have in this country. If I want to watch black content, I clicked 78 on my remote because I'm guaranteed that I will
all
see
the way down
a black face. Other than that, it's not old Ben or something, but something that is going to be uplifting and it's not going to jar me too much. BET is my go-to my gospel. Other than that, in the UK, we don't have a channel that accommodates us in that way.
The thing is, one of the things you just said now, but it's just, we're talking about the American UK, but was Luther written for a black actor? I don't think it was.
I don't know the answer to that.
Because
I don't think it was. But it's one of those things of,
it's kind of like, I think that's where this conversation is going with the, you know, the white man there is. It's about writing roles and just putting the best people in that role. And absolutely. Luther, without being funny, turned Idris into an A-lister. Like he was already to us. He was already Stringer Bell. We, you know, Ultraviolet's one of my favorite shows of all time, and that's 1999.
To me, he's still the guy in Family Affairs.
But. Okay, cool. Okay, cool. But that took him. He can do whatever he wants now. But that's what we're getting. We need to get to that stage where it's just a case of, I've got this. You know, this period piece. It's about a king, and you know, it doesn't have to be about a Eddie Redmayne king. It can be Daniel Kaluuya king. You know, it can be any. That's what we've got to get to.
Dawa, you're going to jump in on the BET point now.
Yeah. Well, it's gotten better. They used to do some programs like Being Mary Jane. I think that's decent. And
love me being Mary Jane.
But I think this is a little off the subject, but I think we have to start developing more artists who are of the African diaspora.
Yeah.
We have to start, being mentors, and we have to start training. That's what's missing is the training.
No, I would agree. Totally. And access to it, Daryl, which is the point that you're saying from a mentoring perspective. And being able to see much wider what is out there. So, for instance, I know individuals like Naima Barnett and those ladies. I've met Ava and people like that. But it's still, even for me in the UK, is so far out of my realm of what I feel. I mean, we've got Amarasanta here, and God bless her. She's doing some amazing work. But even our Destiny's gone to LA. You know, Destiny Akaraga. Mm. So, how do we bridge that gap from where you are with your perspective, especially from a female perspective too? Let me just fly the feminine flag here for a minute, Daryl.
Yeah. So, just repeat that, Daryl, in answer to Paulette's question.
We have to really just start training, and we have to really just start finding those talent, you know, those talented people out there who are black or people of color. I think what's happening in America is, you know, it's remember in the 90s, you could not turn on the television without watching a black episodic television program. The 90s were the decade of black folk. You know, we used to have a network here called UPN.
Dawa, your line's really bad. I'm sure that's a great point you're trying to make there. But we are kind of running short on time. I'll just move it on slightly. We'll come back to you, Dawa. Sorry. We'll come back to you.
All right. I'm doing construction in here. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. You were talking about training, Paulette.
Yes.
And then this was something that Samuel L. Jackson was alluding to in that now infamous radio interview. And then he made the point about David Oyelowo playing Martin Luther King. And for me, watching that interview, that was kind of the most pertinent point of the whole piece for me. Obviously, everyone's got their views on everything else that he said. But in terms of Martin Luther King and going back to the issue of historical figures, a British actor playing Martin Luther King, where do we sit on this?
Well, I think, we're back to the same question. I mean, if they're, you know, if it's being historic and they can pull off the accent believable and they inhabit the persona of the person that they're portraying. I Denzel was way too short to be playing Malcolm X. But we don't worry about it. We don't suddenly go, you've got to be 6 foot. Oh, actually, the producers did at the time. But, you know, generally speaking, the audience will accept anything if the performance is good enough. We will watch it, we'll engage with it. If the character's there, if the development there, if the story's there, we'll buy it.
It's called acting.
Yeah.
It's called acting. I got
some inside feedback on David's performance, which I loved. Mm. But from an American person who was around at the time, they said there was more. It was for them, they liked the performance, but it was the subtleties, it was the nuances, it was the idiosyncrasies of the performance yeah. that weren't quite there for them, equally in keeping with how a black person would have been at that time during that period, during the civil rights, that get kind of lost. Whether that's nitpicking, but I remember being a part of a TV show when the director wanted a particular Jamaican swear word and didn't care about who said it. I was mortally offended. Mm. I'm like, that's not right. And so where do we draw the line for our own preciousness about our...
So you agree with Samuel in that they could have found one black actor in America?
So they could have. Of course they could have. Sorry, I'm going to jump in. They could have, but David pushed that film through. He pushed that film through. That film probably wouldn't have got made without his involvement. So I think
because it does come to the relationship that he has with Ava.
Yeah.
So there's so many different elements to it. It is who you know, what the contact, because he, if I remember rightly, was the one who got Oprah.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So you know, at the end of the day, you're an individual trying to find work for you.
It's funny, Paul Greengrass was going to do a film about Martin Luther King that never happened, and it'd be interesting to see who would have played, because I don't even think they got to the stage where they were talking about casting. But, you know, he probably would have got an American, because that's what Paul Greengrass does. He just goes, he gets really authentic, he gets right in there. Mm. So, you know, that would have been great, hypothetically, but the fact is, David pushed that film through, he got it made, and I think it was a bit of a nitpick, because then what we're saying is that no one can play anyone unless they have a semblance of real world experience to bring to that role. Yeah. That means I can never direct or write a period piece about a man. It's set in the 1800s.
Well,
that rationale.
Yeah, but is that a difference between writing and directing or performance?
No, because you're still creatively embodying. So as a director, I have to live that. If I'm making a movie, I have to live that movie for 2 years. I have to embed myself into that. I have to be nearly as much of the character as the actor.
The important thing to remember about Selma is he wasn't allowed to speak any of Martin Luther King's words. So you've already taken a step outside before you even start. We're talking about one of the most historic characters and they're not allowed to use the actual speech.
Right.
I mean, I'll never forget, I digress a little, but it's pertinent because when I watched Half of a Yellow Sun with my younger brother and my wife, at the time, as Igbos, it was quite interesting to see Thandie Newton on screen. And the same issues are coming up as we're talking about it now. Of all the actresses in Nollywood, you couldn't find one to play that role. And it offended my younger brother so much, who doesn't really watch films as much as I do, but for him to just kind of, because obviously being grown up in that culture, the Igbos are a very proud kind of culture. So for the BFI, which funded that film, to make that decision, and for the writer of the film, obviously it's based on a book, true story, et cetera, to allow that to happen. I guess these questions are always going to be talked about because it seems like the mistakes, and I use the word loosely, mistakes, they keep getting made and people are conscious that they're doing these things to the extent whereby they don't think there's going to be a backlash. Well, clearly there is. Obviously we've talked about Michael Jackson earlier with Joseph Fiennes. And obviously, the reactions were just normal people just watching films and just thinking, that's not right. That shouldn't be happening.
But this reaction came about because Get Out started making money. Get Out started making money. It made a lot of money. And if that film hadn't made as much money, no one would have bothered. No one would have been bothered. It made $200 million, had the biggest opening weekend for an R-rated
movie. My guy's English.
And that's why this argument sometimes gets me really, really heated, because it came down to the fact that his film made money, he's British, it's an American movie. So you kind of have to disregard it.
I actually don't like Get Out, but that's for another
talk, that isn't it?
I absolutely loved it.
Darryl,
4-1, I think.
Darryl, what's your thoughts on Selma and David the Yellow Row?
I didn't have an issue with it. I didn't have an issue with that at all. I think, and I'm gonna come from a social perspective, I think with all the backlash and all the yip-yap about it, I think it's very divisive. I think we have no place for that in our society. Mm-hmm. I think whatever actor takes on a role, if they can capitalize on the nuances and really make that character, that role, believable and really live in the character, I don't have an issue with it, especially when it comes to us as Black people, because they're all over the diaspora. I think we celebrate Martin Luther King just like you guys celebrate Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was not just a hero for Americans, but he was speaking for Black people throughout the world. And I think that it's very divisive when we do those types of things. I think that there's a lot of work happening in America, and there's a lot of Black people doing great things in America. And I never understood why Samuel Jackson made those comments. And I'm sorry to go off on a rant, but you can tell I'm pissed about this, because I thought it was very I thought it was very divisive. And we as a people, we don't need not just capitalize on all the talent in the world, and we all just make great films. I had no issues with David playing Martin Luther King. What Martin Luther King was to him probably was what he was to me. He was a man that meant something. That doesn't mean David, who's British, can't have those same feelings and can't have that same resonance with Martin Luther King.
Okay, Dal, I'm gonna have to cut you. Not literally, but just the signal is just. But
I know it sucks.
It does. It really does. And you swore as well, so maybe I should cut you. But let's leave it there. Our time is up. My thanks to this week's critics, who have been Paul Atherton, Paulette Harris-German, Darryl Sledge, and Isaac Tomacek. And remember, they're not the only ones. So until we meet the critics again next time, from everyone on the team and from me, thank you for listening.
This is Colorful Radio.